Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, November 3rd, 2011. Tech News Today is brought to you by the Epson Workforce Pro, the world's fastest two-sided printer, delivering high-speed automatic printing, copying, scanning, and faxing to keep your business running at full speed. Plus, you'll save on ink. The Epson Workforce Pro, check it out at Epson.com. And by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, so you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Check it out in the 2012 Ford Fiesta and at Ford.com/technology. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Jason Holloway back here.
And no Ayaz Akhtar. He's off today, but we're happy to be joined by co-founder of Gadget.com, Pete Rojas. Peter Rojas, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. It's been we've had Ryan Block, your co-founder, on several times, but I don't know why we haven't had you on before. So I'm glad we finally corralled you in.
I feel like we have. Am I just
No, I've never been on.
Up?
I mean, I've been on other shows there, but I haven't been on Tech News Today before.
Well,
yeah.
It was time.
It was absolutely time. Is your audio there? I heard a big loud click. I want to make sure it wasn't Peter.
You know what? It may be this horrible old headset I have.
Okay.
It sounds good otherwise.
Stay
we can
very
still hear
still.
You. So yeah,
I'm
exactly.
not I'm going to move. I'm going to just
Don't
be like,
move. Okay. Top story, actually freshest story. HTC had another announcement. They're bringing them fast and furious these days. The HTC Resound will be coming to Verizon Wireless, available at Verizon stores and Best Buy November 14th with a $299 price tag. This is one that was called the Vigor, if you saw the rumors about it earlier, and then the Resound with an S in some places. Has gingerbread, although they say it's going to be ice cream sandwich ready, so it'll get ice cream sandwich early next year.
Isn't any phone with gingerbread ice cream sandwich ready?
Theoretically, yeah. I don't know really how much they're saying there, except you're not getting ice cream sandwich until after the first of the year. 1280 by 720 pixel resolution display, 1.5 gigahertz dual core processor. You know, the specs don't blow me away. It is an LTE phone. It's got those Beats by Audio headphones in there. So our first Dr. Dre phone.
The way that you're listing off these features makes it sound lackluster. Are you not interested?
It's not lackluster. You're right. I shouldn't dismiss it. 1.5 gigahertz dual core. That's fine. Gigabyte of RAM. That's fine. But
I mean, 720p display. I'd say it's on par with a lot of what the Galaxy Nexus is offering.
I think that's it, on par.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing. It's like, it's hard to be more excited about this than about the Galaxy Nexus, especially since the Nexus will ship with Ice Cream Sandwich, and it'll be at least 2 or 3 months before this thing gets it.
And it's a thicker phone. It's not like it's super slim. It does have like some red and black accents, so it's got some interesting stuff going on with the look, but it doesn't blow me away. I'm not like, wow, this is the prettiest phone I've ever seen.
Well, it may be the thickness leads to better battery life. That's sometimes the case.
That would be fantastic if that were true. I'm not going to hold my breath, but... and it's got the Sense UI, if you're a fan of the Sense UI and all that. It's a perfectly fine phone.
Sure.
I will say nothing.
I guess if you're an HTC, I don't know, if you're loyal to HTC or you're really interested in Beats Audio and the whole ice cream sandwich being a couple months away rather than tomorrow isn't that big a deal to you, then it's a great phone.
Beats Audio seems to be its significantly different factor from everything else. And I'm not sure how much
but
that
the jury's kind of still out whether that's just marketing or actually a really good feature that you want.
It's kind of like Bose in that way, isn't it? Where it's like, don't know that it's any better, really.
Right.
But it's cool.
Yeah. It's expensive, so it must be good.
I like Dr. Dre.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I mean,
it'll ship with some decent headphones, that's for sure.
There you go. Yeah. Exactly. Positive. Amazon announced the Kindle Owners Lending Library, which when you first hear, Kindle's going to allow you to check out books for free if you are an Amazon Prime member. Sounds pretty awesome, but there are a few caveats. First one is that you have to be an Amazon Prime subscriber.
Which is $80 a year.
You also only get one book per month, although there's no return date. You can keep it as long as you want.
It's kind of like a Netflix model in a way.
You are going to have to be using a Kindle device. It will not work on the Kindle apps. So a Kindle Fire when it comes out or one of the Kindle e-ink readers.
Mm-hmm.
And you will not be able to read any of the books you want. It's only got 5,000 ebooks at launch, and none of them are from the big six publishers. So, yeah, you might be able to find some books you want in here, but it's pretty limited.
I actually think this is a great idea for, I mean, you figure that, and I don't know, I mean, I'm just guessing here, but I would say that someone who actually owns a Kindle rather than reading on a Kindle app on their iPad, for example, is probably reading more books overall. You know, they like the Kindle experience. If you're an Amazon Prime member, I mean, some people are Amazon Prime members just because they love free shipping or faster shipping in some cases. So it's like, wow, just a bunch of free books. That's great. And I can take my time reading them because I don't have to give them back in 10 days. But yeah, when I first read this, I was like, 5,000 ebooks? That can't be, that number's wrong. It's Amazon we're talking about. They have to have more than 5,000 books just because.
No big publishers.
Yeah. So.
It's the publishers that are making the restrictions. And I think that it reminds me a little bit about when they announced that they were having the video on demand service for Prime members. And that you could, you know, watch anything in their library, but it was a pretty limited library to start when it's growing over time. And I think that they would like to eventually have like a Netflix model for books where you pay, say, like $10 or $15 a month and you can check out like a limited number of ebooks per month. Having that recurring revenue is going to be better for them in the long run rather than just relying on book sales, which kind of ebb and flow.
And they've got different deals with different publishers. And I sort of want to hedge my bets or hedge what I said about nothing you want to read. I mean, they do have some good indie publishers in here. If you're into The Hunger Games, you can read that. There's some Richard Dawkins books listed here. Michael Lewis, guy who wrote Moneyball. Moneyball's in here. So it's not like there's nothing to choose from. Some publishers are getting a flat fee for this. Other publishers are getting reportedly the same revenue they would get per book as if it were sold. So I think this is really just an experiment by Amazon to see how well this works, how the revenue model works, so then they can take some of that data to the big publishers and say, okay, here's how it's going to work. Mm-hmm. You might want to put some of your back catalog in here to build interest, or you might want to, you know, consider using it in different ways. But the big publishers are just kind of holding off.
Do you think anybody's going to buy an actual Kindle, you know, either a Fire or an e-ink Kindle just for something like this? Because I don't have a Kindle. I read Kindle books.
It might.
But I don't actually have a Kindle.
I don't know. Peter, do you have an answer to that?
You know, I don't think anyone will buy it just for this, but I think what it does is it creates more loyalty out of the people that do buy those e-ink readers and that are going to buy the Kindle Fire. And I think that, you know, when you take like all the range of the services and you know, media stuff that is available, you know, Amazon is just trying to like kind of get people addicted to their ecosystem and make it harder for people to want to leave. Right. And, you know, stuff like this does make it harder down the line. I mean, it's not going to be 5,000 books forever. It'll be 50,000 books at some point. And all of a sudden it's like, well, you know, I could switch and, you know, go to whatever else is out there, but I'm going to give up this perk. And that's going to be hard to give up.
It could be a deciding factor between e-readers. If you've decided I want to buy an e-reader, I'm not sure if I want the Nook or the Sony e-reader or the Amazon. This could be one of those things that sways you. But yeah, I agree with Peter. It's probably not the deciding factor. Motorola announced two new Zooms coming out. The Zoom 2s are coming to the UK and Ireland in mid-November. The Zoom 2 will be £329, 330 pounds. That's 528 US. And the media edition Zoom 2 will be £380. That's $609 US. I'm sorry, I got those backwards. It's 380 for the standard Zoom 2, £330 for the media edition. The standard Zoom 2 will be 10 inches. Edges have been designed with a flattened edge that supposedly makes it easier to hold. Comes with some businessy stuff like VPN and data encryption support, active sync, a USB port, and an Ethernet port. The 8.2-inch media edition sports a 178-degree viewing angle, virtual surround sound, dual core, and both of them have dual core 1.2 gigahertz processors and run Android 3.2. So no ice cream sandwich coming to these right off the bat either. They have Wi-Fi connectivity, 8.3 megapixel camera, front end and a rear 5 megapixel camera, digital zoom, autofocus, all this stuff. MotoCast, I don't know how much that matters to folks, and a splash guard coating.
Nice.
So if you just spit on it,
tableting in the rain,
it won't.
It's going to be okay.
Motorola is betting on this to kind of pick up where a very disappointing Zoom left off.
What did they sell? About 100,000 units?
Yeah, their first round.
Not very many.
Yeah, 100,000 in the last quarter. So it's been like 100,000 every time. Is this going to save Motorola's tablet line, Peter?
Nope. I don't think it's going to make enough of a difference. And I'm not sure that the problem is really the hardware anymore. I think it's because the hardware that's being produced by these guys and Samsung and Acer and others, it's all pretty good. It's not, you know, as good as the iPad necessarily, but it's all, you know, pretty solid. The real problem is that this, like, Honeycomb has not been good enough in terms of the responsiveness of the software. The UI is really confusing. And I think that they're going to try to solve a lot of those issues in Ice Cream Sandwich, but, you know, it remains to be seen what Ice Cream Sandwich looks like on a tablet and what that experience is like and whether it's going to be enough of an improvement to really, you know, turn people's heads.
Especially when you consider that Ice Cream Sandwich, to a large degree, was kind of modeled after what we saw in parts in Honeycomb.
Yeah, so. Yeah, and I think that's a negative.
Yeah.
Like, that's a, to me, and I'm a big Android fan, and I'm looking forward to the Nexus. Probably be my next phone, but I really hope that they learn the right lessons from Honeycomb and not the wrong lessons. And I'm worried that, you know, if you spend time with the Honeycomb tablet, the UI is just, it's just really, really bizarre in places and non-intuitive.
I also think the earmarked edges are a little strange.
Really?
They say it makes it easier to hold, but were people really having a hard time holding tablets?
I don't know if that's necessarily it. I think what it does to me when I look at it, it makes me not think of the iPad when I look at it immediately.
Well, that's true, and I'm sure that that's intentional.
Well, yeah.
It just kind of makes it look like an octagon or something.
Yeah.
I also don't understand why the media edition would be smaller. Wouldn't my media edition want a larger screen?
Yeah,
if I'm going to watch videos.
Too.
I mean, 8.2 inches isn't too small, but still, why not just make
it? It's actually a pretty good size for a screen.
Yeah, yeah, it's all right. I don't know. Maybe I'm just used to
media editions being like the bigger television,
yeah,
or the
maybe.
Bigger speakers, or maybe. The bigger subwoofer.
Let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Epson. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by the Epson Workforce Pro, the world's fastest two-sided inkjet printer. We've got one here in the studio. Epson's engineered the Workforce Pro for productivity, delivers high-speed automatic two-sided color printing, does copying, scanning, and faxing too. It's a multifunction machine, keeps your business running at full speed, and they designed the Workforce Pro to help you save on ink, because that's the biggest complaint people have is, God, I have to spend so much on ink cartridges. Well, the ink cartridges are extra high capacity, and they give you 50% less cost per page versus color lasers. So you got more ink and you use less of it. Workforce Pro prints for mobile devices like smartphones and tablets, and man, it works so easy. I'm printing from my iPhone. I couldn't believe that I didn't run into bugs. I didn't run into problems. I just pressed the button and it printed. 580 sheet paper capacity means you load paper less often. It's the Epson Workforce Pro. Check it out at Epson.com. Epson built to perform, and we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. All right, so we got a couple of related stories here about the music industry, well, the music and the media industry. Nate Anderson has a great write-up over at Ars Technica today about a report from the International Intellectual Property Alliance. This was commissioned by copyright holders, by the industry. And the new report, it issued in association with the Congressional International Anti-Piracy Caucus at an event in Washington, D.C., as Nate points out, shows that they've dropped the estimates of lost dollars to piracy. They're no longer playing that game of saying we lost this $1 billion to piracy, which is usually a gross exaggeration. They're just not even saying that anymore. It indicates that copyright industry jobs pay better than most American jobs. So the idea that job losses are being caused, out the window. The copyright industry, or at least, you know, media supported by copyright, has outperformed the U.S. economy through the recession. And they have sold record-setting amounts of products overseas, earning more foreign revenue than the entire U.S. food sector or the U.S. pharmaceutical companies. And foreign is why we're getting things like ACTA. Foreign is why everyone says, oh, well, we need stronger copyright laws in the U.S., but we really have to force stronger copyright laws overseas. It looks like their jobs are staying, they're paying better, they're outperforming the rest of the U.S. economy, and they're selling record amounts of product overseas. I don't get the justification for needing Protect IP and SOPA and all these stronger copyright protections. Seems like the current copyright laws are treating these guys just fine.
Yeah, I mean, VP of the MPAA, Michael O'Leary, says In the United States, it's imperative that Congress passes legislation halting content theft by rogue websites, which will help sustain the crafts that historically and consistently make such a valued contribution to America's economy. You read that and you're like, ooh, gosh, these guys are in trouble. I mean, they really need to pass legislation to keep this industry intact because it's in trouble. It's very healthy. It's doing great.
Yeah. What they're trying to say is, the threat of piracy could ruin this amazing industry that's doing so well.
Sure.
But the threat of piracy is actually reduced in the past decade, not increased, without these huge copyright laws that they're trying to push on us. Peter, what do you make of this?
I mean, I think, like, you know, these guys have always tried to overestimate the actual amount of damage that's been done. And they've always counted a pirated, you know, music or film or TV show as a lost sale, which is not always true, right? You know, there's a lot of people that pirate shows that we're never going to spend, or music or whatever, they're never going to, you know, spend those dollars in the first place. I think that, you know, what we've seen over the past 10 years is the emergence of services that let people, you know, that are good enough that people will pay for them, and they're good substitutes for piracy. I mean, I think, you know, the online streaming music services are a good example of that. If Spotify and RDO and Rhapsody are you know, kind of indicative of how you can build a service that people will pay for that makes them not want to pirate anymore.
I think it's a really weak argument to say our industry is so strong, if we don't, we have draconian laws, then we might lose it. I'm glad to see them drop those estimates you're talking about and stop talking about lost dollars to piracy. But this really just shows what I've been saying for years, which is the industry is going to do just fine as long as they put out a better product. And when they put out undRM'd MP3s, the music industry started doing better. When they started to allow streaming of television shows online, like places like Hulu, the industry started doing better. Yeah, there's issues, and you got to work through those, especially with licensing and advertising and how to best go about transitioning to this new place. But we don't need draconian property laws that actually roll back our civil rights and the ability to do fair use of intellectual property. I think that this shows very damningly that those laws are not necessary. So hopefully people can make that case on Congress and stop things like Protect IP and SOPA, which I think would be more damaging to our economy.
I mean, I think what it comes down to is, you know, as a society, do we think that, you know, we can collectively sort of, you know, decide what we really want to encourage, and that, like, we can, you know, change some of the rules around copyright and intellectual property, not to, like, I mean, obviously not get rid of them entirely, but to say, you know, that the internet does change the reality on the ground, and that can we have a greater economic prosperity to build new kinds of industries and new kinds of economies, so to speak, around the new ways in which, you know, content and creative works can be, you know, shared and distributed online. And I mean, it's a tough discussion to have at the governmental level, because fundamentally, you know, a lot of people that are in, you know, government don't understand this stuff, unfortunately.
That's why Gadget needs to get really successful so you can hire lobbyists.
Yeah, maybe I'll just start a lobbying group after this. Yeah, that'd maybe be more useful.
And this is the related story here, I like what EMI Music is doing. And of course, EMI tends to be a little ahead of this because they're the worst performing, so they're more desperate. But they're offering developers a way to leapfrog licensing so that they can then develop apps around EMI's music. So there's 12,000 pre-cleared songs that a developer can use to make an app. And then EMI has to approve that app for use, and EMI becomes the publisher and then splits the take. 60% goes to the label for net revenue and to pay the rights holders of the music, and then 40% is split between the developers and a company called Echo Nest, which helped cobble the deal together. So your developer split is kind of low here. You're getting less than 40%. But what they're doing is the right idea, which is saying, hey, we've got a bunch of music. Let's make it easy for people to innovate with this, instead of making it hard by making them license every single track for every single use that they want to do with it.
Well, it's also smart for them because they're saying, hey, developers, be creative and give us more than half of your profits.
So artist apps are probably the most obvious use for this. If I want to have I want to have some developers out there just making fan apps that include the music of an artist, mm-hmm. EMI would want to encourage that. But you could do games that have music in them, things like Tap Tap come to mind. And
Right, you probably wouldn't bother putting together a Shazam-like service because most of the music that you
because you only got 12, or a Spotify,
you don't have enough of a database.
That's
but
a good first step, though.
Yeah, like something that was like a karaoke app, for example, where it's like you got 12,000 songs here, and if it's popular enough, then it might be a hit with developers.
Who knows? Anyway, good example of not trying to rely on old business models, but trying to find new ways of making money off of what you have.
Well, I mean, isn't the challenge for guys like EMI and the major labels in general that, you know, over time, their relevance, their proportion of the music that's out there that people care about is just going to go down, right?
Exactly.
I don't think, you know, it used to be some huge, you know, whatever, 80, 90% of, you know, most music that was that people cared about came from a major label. And now that proportion is just dropping, you know, year after year after year. And, you know, if these guys don't participate in these sorts of things, I mean, they're just going to be left out entirely.
Yeah. Absolutely true. Bloomberg reporting that RIM fell below book value today. Book value is what you are worth, net value of your property, patents, and other assets. So if you just sold off everything for parts, RIM is estimated, at least at the end of the last quarter, at $18.92 a share. At 10:27 a.m. New York time, they hit $18.37 a share. So that's the first time they'd gone below the value of their parts since 2002. Now, I didn't get a chance to look at RIM's stock at the close today, so let's see where they ended up closing out. Yahoo Finance says they finished at $18.85, so they finished below book value. And John Goldsmith, money manager with Montrusco in Toronto, says book value may actually be inflated because the patents that they value are old and may not be worth what they think they're worth. This is... I don't know what to say. I'm almost rooting for RIM as an underdog at this point, but I don't see any good news coming from them.
You know, these guys have made so many mistakes over the past few years. And, you know, I mean, setting aside whether or not they're trading below or at, you know, book value, I think it's just a huge vote of no confidence on the part of investors. Nobody wants to hold the stock because very few people think that RIM is going to turn this around and start, you know, increasing their smartphone sales again. I mean, I think they're one of the few makers of smartphones that actually lost share over the, you know, and over the past few years. And,
RIM or, and
you
Nokia,
know,
and, right?
Yeah, and Nokia and like, but also lost like volume, you know, which just says that like they're, you know, people are defecting in droves. And I think that, you know, the Nokia coming out with Windows Phone, I think that's actually going to hurt RIM even more because I think that, you know, the contrast now between, you know, the OS is from the Windows Phone OS and iOS and Android, there's just such a stark contrast between what those guys are offering and what you get with a BlackBerry.
And let's be clear, some people in the chat room are like, oh, so RIM is broke. No, RIM, I believe, if I have this right, is actually profitable. It's just
This doesn't mean that they're not profitable or that they're out of money. It just means that in terms of the market capitalization, the value of the company in terms of the stock means that, you know, if you sold the company for parts, sold off like its various businesses and counted the cash that they have on hand and other assets, that it would be worth more than, you know, what the company is valued in terms of its total outstanding stock.
Which is what you said. It's a vote of confidence or a vote of no confidence.
For no confidence, yeah. Exactly. And you see this happen. I mean, you do see this happen from time to time where a company, I mean, sometimes a company will have more cash in the bank than their market cap.
Yeah.
And that really says a lot, you know. I mean, RIM is obviously not in that situation, but, you know, people aren't buying, you know, people aren't buying the stock or selling the stock because they don't feel like it's going to appreciate in value.
And it would be a great time for someone to acquire RIM, but RIM's not interested in selling from what I read.
Yeah, they could be. I mean, it'd be an interesting sort of hostile, you know, takeover attempt. I don't know how, you know, who owns most of those shares, but it's hard to imagine them continuing on as an independent company 5 years from now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I remember talking about, you know, this a couple of years ago that there were now like, remember there were like 7 or 8 different smartphone OSs on the market?
Yeah.
And everybody knew like, this won't stay like this forever. Like the market can't support this many different platforms. And now it's like shaking out. Like this is basically the year that it all shook out, right? WebOS, you know, committed suicide, BlackBerry's falling apart, you know, Symbian's gone, and you're seeing like the market winnow down to basically what it can support. And I think the market can support maybe three or four.
Yeah. Somebody should buy RIM for, if nothing else, for the technology they have. They have great technology. They have great networking and messaging services that are fantastic, and they're still fantastic. Even with the outage that they had, they still overall do very well at that, and that would be valuable for somebody. I agree with Peter. I think in 5 years you won't see RIM as an independent.
I just can't see it happening.
Yeah. Let's finish up with Anonymous. Of course, you can never talk about Anonymous as if it's an organization. We often do, but it's a mistake, really. Barrett Brown, who is a writer and oft-times sort of an informal spokesperson for Anonymous Ops, posted a YouTube video yesterday explaining that Op Cartel, we've been talking about this for a few days, the operation for Anonymous members to demand that one of their operatives be released by a drug cartel in Mexico, or they will start doxing them. They'll start giving out documents of who these people are. Barrett Brown put a YouTube up saying that the op is back on. He says, the fact of the matter is this operation is going ahead whether or not I get involved. He says he's looked over some of the docs that they have, and he believes that they're accurate and that they're being very careful with who they expose and that they understand the risks in a drug cartel as far as retaliation. But because the people who want to operate Op Cartel are in Mexico and directly in the line of fire, he says that they took a vote in the IRC channel and decided to go ahead with it. Now, what's interesting about this is one of the first times we've seen an actual video with a face instead of somebody in a Guy Fawkes mask. And Barrett Brown has been known to be associated with Anonymous. It's not like we have never heard from him before, but it was fairly bold of him to do that. When asked on Twitter why he did it that way, he said, it was because I was asked to do so by several Mexicans who are risking their lives for this.
Barrett Brown is a really interesting character, too. D Magazine had written earlier this year, back in March, kind of along, this is who this guy is, this is kind of his backstory, this is why he's maybe a little bit eccentric. I don't know. The whole thing is very fascinating, and I'm just really frightened for all these people. You know, I mean, we're talking about potential really violent behavior, and it's just, I don't know what to make of it. I read all these stories and I think, I just hope everybody stays safe.
It's different than the previous Anonymous or WikiLeaks operations because you're dealing with a drug cartel and not a government. We talked about that on Monday. It is some people who are tired of being pushed around by the cartel, don't have the muscle or the firepower to take them on in one way, but feel like this is their weapon. They know how to operate anonymously. They know how to operate online, and they can expose information. So it's a little bit of that WikiLeaks ethos there, except being used against the Zetas drug cartel. Peter, have you been following this story much?
Just a little bit. I mean, the part that I was trying to figure out is how much are the cartels even operating online? Right, in terms of like information that Anonymous would be able to really access, and that was sort of the thing that wasn't totally clear to me, because obviously with a government or a company, they operate online and you know, hacking and leaking information from them is, I'm not gonna say it's always easy, but it's obviously you kind of know that it's there and you know that they're operating that way. But it's not clear to me that, you know, are the Mexican drug cartels like, you know, using Google Docs to organize
It's not like you can DDoS the cartel. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not like they have websites that they, you know, you, if they shut down their website, they're not going to care probably. You know, if you were able to infiltrate their, you know, cell phones or something like that, that's a different story. But I think the idea
is you're going to dox them. You're going to expose people who deal with them, expose their informants, expose who they are. They say they've got data that includes the name of a U.S. district attorney who allegedly cooperated with the Zetas. So I suppose it's that kind of...
But where are they getting it from? I mean, are they hacking Mexican government databases or something? Or is it...
Right.
You know, that where they have like kind of lists of suspects, or it just wasn't clear to me. And
stealing
maybe I missed
thumb drives.
But.
Yeah. No, I it's not clear to me either what the source of the information is. All right, let's move on to the news fuse. AT&T is going to have another court battle on its hands. U.S. District Judge Ellen Huvell ruled that Sprint and C Spire Wireless can pursue part of their antitrust lawsuit against AT&T's proposed acquisition of T-Mobile. The judge agreed to allow the companies to pursue their injury claims about the effect the deal would have on the market for wireless devices, but she did throw out other claims involving spectrum and backhaul.
Let's take a trip to the rumor mill.
Hey, look, kids.
I love it here. DigiTimes is reporting Apple will completely overhaul its product portfolios next year, this year. Everything from the iPad, an iPhone, iMac, MacBook Air, the whole thing. DigiTimes, which sometimes uncritically reports whatever suppliers tell them, also says the next gen of iPads will have an inventory of 2 million units by December, and the next iPhone will go into production in June 2012.
I mean, predicting new Apple products is like shooting fish in a barrel.
You just say, whatever.
Yeah. I think they're going to have a new iPhone and a new iPad.
Yeah. Just go out on a limb, right?
I'm full of wind. Financial Times not only opted out of Apple's in-app payment system, but pulled their app altogether in favor of a web app. How'd they do? Well, Financial Times' digital subscriber base grew by 8% during the past period. Financial Times stopped offering its iPad and iPhone apps for download on August 30th, so only 1 month in the past three that they included had no app available. But they claim that a fifth of their web traffic comes from the web app.
As of the next St. David's Day, which is March 1st, 2012, Apple will require all apps submitted to the Mac App Store to implement sandboxing. Apple says that sandboxing your app is a great way to protect systems and users by limiting the resources that apps can access, making it more difficult for malicious software to compromise user systems. Many critics worry, though, that this could dumb down apps and also kill off AppleScript.
Andy Anatko is one of those people saying, hey, you know what, I'm not sure this is such a great idea to require.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe an option, but iOS 5.0.1 beta came out to developers Wednesday, and developers are claiming the forthcoming update has the fix for the iPhone 4S battery issues. Also seems to fix the security flaw on the iPad involving the cover. That's the one that allowed people to bypass the lock screen and then see whatever app happened to be in the foreground when it was closed.
HP's got a new tablet, but it's not WebOS, and it's not $99.
Oh,
it's a successor to the all-but-forgotten HP Slate 500. The Windows 7-based Slate 2 comes with an 8.9-inch capacitive multi-touch screen, an Intel Atom Z670 CPU, 32 gigabytes of storage space, 3-megapixel back camera, as well as a front-facing VGA camera for video calls. The HP Slate 2 starts at $699. That's $699, and is expected to be available worldwide later this month.
Get your Windows 7 tablets while they still exist.
Feels like a placeholder for Windows 8 tablet. I mean, obviously, but...
Yeah, it's an enterprise device. I mean, I think that's the only place they're possibly going to sell that, right?
Yeah. I haven't seen any marketing towards consumers for it at all.
Amazon Flow is a new iOS app that they call augmented reality, but honestly, it's really just a fancy version of Red Laser. You point the app at any product with a barcode, and Flow will bring up how much the product costs on Amazon, as well as offering you reviews and possibly some video or audio, which could be handy for DVDs, see a clip from the movie you're looking at. Whether you choose instant gratification of buying what's in front of you or order it for cheap on Amazon, that's going to be entirely up to you. The app can't help you there.
Twitter is testing a new feature that highlights a link labeled as top news or a profile labeled as top people at the top of its search results. A small percentage of users will see a link to a news story, or if they're searching for a person, an influential Twitter account at the top of the search results in addition to relevant tweets.
And finally, the One Laptop Per Child project plans to drop their inexpensive touchscreen computers from helicopters near remote villages in developing countries. The devices will be left for the villagers to find, distribute, support, and use all on their own. The computers will have solar-powered batteries that will allow them to be used in regions without access to electricity.
I feel like there's a joke in there.
Gods must be crazy. Yeah. Let's move on to the randomizer. A new Loma Kino video camera shoots lo-fi movies on film, but is capturing a lot of information. It's a plastic 35 millimeter film camera from Soviet era Russia that added a movie camera to its lineup. You were pretty excited about this, Jason.
Well, I just thought it was really cool looking. It kind of reminded me of what we see in like the Instagram / photo filters on your phone thing. Although this is the real deal, this is actually a hardware camera that basically takes a 36 roll exposure roll and cuts it into 144 frames. You need a Lomo Kinoscope to view the film, which is hand cranked. The camera itself is $79, and then the viewer bundle with the camera and the viewer is $99. It made me wonder how long until, if it hasn't already started happening, like when do we start seeing those competitors like Instagram doing this for video,
right?
And kind of doing the whole retro kind of film.
You can do that.
There's
in
somebody
apps
that's
right
doing
now.
That. Yeah.
Is there?
I'm trying
Somebody's
to.
Somebody's doing that, like an Instagram for video with filters. I'm trying. I wish I could remember.
I think
their
it's
name
called
right
8mm, at least for the iPad. That works fairly well. It doesn't look like this, though. This is more of a...
This is a little more authentic.
The Lomography community would get behind.
Well, the camera's $79, and if you want the viewer, you can get it as a bundle for $99. So it's a hobbyist thing.
Totally.
And then you can,
it's kind of cool.
You can be all snobby and be like, well, you're using an app. See, I'm using an actual Lomography.
Right. I'm a purist.
Yeah.
I bought this thing.
Exactly. All right, let's before we get to the calendar, thank our other sponsor. This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Ford, featuring available voice-activated Sync App Link, enables you to control select apps from your smartphone with voice commands. You keep your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road, and you say, thumbs up, Pandora, I like that song. Or thumbs down, Pandora, I hate that song, and now change it to a different channel. Also have an app called OpenBeak, which can read your Twitter at replies, read your timeline to you. All of this stuff, you just say, you know, Ford Sync, do this. You press a button on the wheel and you talk to your car. It's quite amazing. And Sync App Link is built on an API platform, so they're working with developers to make all kinds of apps available on this thing. Check it out on the new 2012 Ford Fiesta, and you can learn more about this and other technologies at Ford.com/technology. And don't forget about the barbecue. You're going to the barbecue, right, Sarah?
Yes, I will be here. I wouldn't miss it.
Coming up Sunday, November 13th here in Petaluma, or Sunday, December 4th, we're going to do another one. You do need tickets, so if you're going to be around and you'd like to stop by the Twit Studio, see them record this week in tech, see the beta version of Game on November 13th, go to twit.tv and sign up for the barbecue tickets. We'd love to see you here. And thanks to Ford for bringing us the Twit Sunday barbecue and, of course, Tech News Today. Let's look at the calendar.
OpenBSD 5.0 is launched, offering OpenSSH 5.8, more hardware compatibility, and fewer bugs. You can get it at an FTP server near you. The Galaxy Tab 7.0 Plus is supposed to be released on November 13th, although The Verge is reporting it seems like Amazon's deciding not to go ahead and start shipping, to go ahead and start shipping Samsung's reworked 7-inch tablet with Honeycomb now. All right, so that's not the 13th, that's now. Google Offer issued its first nationwide offer in the U.S. Want to know what it was? $25 worth of outdoor gear at REI for $15. They also launched an offers app for Android. I like REI. $10 off.
Yeah,
good
sure.
stuff. We can finally figure out what's going on at that Canon Hollywood event. It's actually, and Gadget's live blogging it right now. The camera is called the Canon EOS C300. It's a film cam. It's from what I can get so far. It's they had so much success with people using the Canon what HD Mark II. 5D Mark II. Using it for such beautiful film imagery that they've taken it a step further and they've created the C300 to actually be made for films. Right now they're in the middle of people in the industry talking about what a great camera it is, how it's lightweight, how it's more compact, how the pictures are beautiful. It reads skin tone really well. So definitely there'll be a lot of write-ups about this once they finish their event. But cool stuff from Canon. And, you know, Red was supposed to be announcing changes to the Scarlett Camera Plus shipping information, but they haven't done it yet.
Haven't done it yet.
No, I can't find anything online yet.
They will.
Yeah, sometime today. Which is all very exciting. Lots of camera and film community information in the show.
Let's check what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Andrew writes in and says, Grand Theft Auto started in Liberty City, which was a fake New York City. But the first game way back in the 90s swung through Vice City, a fake Miami, and San Andreas, fake Los Angeles. We were trying to remember all the cities.
I see.
Thank you, Andrew.
Got
That's awesome. Appreciate the email.
Cool. Want me to read the second one?
Sure.
This is Amy from London, Ontario. Hey, TNT crew, has announced this week that the CRTC here in Canada is making Rogers test the viability and popularity of an a la carte TV model, and they're going to be testing it here in my home, London, Ontario. Starts November 8th, and it'll run until March. I'm going to sign up since right now our household is paying Rogers $130 plus per month for our cable and internet package, and we have plenty of channels we just don't want. We're missing some that we'd like that are bundled with packages that we don't like. With this, we'd pay $20 base price for our basic internet channels, and then another $26 for 15 extra channels of our choice, incrementally more if we'd like more channels. I really hope it goes well here, as Rogers is probably hoping that the opposite happens, so they can tell the CRTC that consumers didn't want it, and that would suck.
Yeah, I hope it goes well, too.
I hope it goes well,
It's the first actual a la carte. I mean, it's not picking every individual channel, but
it's
at least you get to pick your package of 15.
Yeah.
They're not saying, well, you pay $10 for the sports package, and there's like 30 sports packages there. That's pretty cool.
I hope it's a big hit.
All right, folks, thanks for submitting stories at our Reddit. TechNewsToday.reddit.com helps us figure out what stories we want to cover each day on Tech News Today. Over 3,000 folks in there. You don't have to spend a lot of time. Just go in and vote on some stories, or you can submit stories as well. We appreciate that. And don't forget to submit your favorite moments of any Twitch show, including Tech News Today, at twit.tv/bestof. We're starting to put together our end-of-year specials. Obviously, there are more great moments to come between now and the end of the year. But any of the good moments you have, especially if you know the date, the episode number, the time code, put it all there, twit.tv/bestof. Peter Rojas, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
It was great. I hope we can have you on again much sooner than, 264 episodes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I understand.
And let folks know about Gadget, what they can find there and what...
Yeah, I mean, it's like we have an amazing community. It's a place where people can review and ask questions about their gadgets. And we kind of say that I like to think that we have the best and smartest community of gadget nerds on the web.
It's a great way to keep track of what you have, as well as sort of what you want. Like when I use it a lot when people are like, you know, well, what are you looking forward to? What do you want to buy next? I'm just like, point to GDGT.com. It's like, this is it. There's my list.
Yeah. I mean, we offer users these beautiful profile pages where you can kind of show off your collection of stuff. And I find it pretty handy because, I mean, actually one of the reasons why Ryan and I started the site in the first place is people were always asking us like, well, what do you guys use? Like, what camera do you use? What TV do you have? Because they were looking for recommendations and suggestions. And we thought, well, what better way than just to create a site where you could just go look at stuff whenever you wanted.
Yeah, it's good stuff. GDGT.com. Thanks again, Peter Rojas. And thanks to you folks for being on, watching the show, listening to the show. Twit.tv/TNT is our website address. You can email us, TNT@twit.tv, or give us a call, 260-TNT-SHOW. Darren Kitchen joins us tomorrow. We'll see you then.